Immigration, healthcare reform, going to be a big week for the U.S. Supreme Court.
And in Egypt, a new leader, and we'll ask about the economic future of that country. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, June 25th. Lots of good stuff in the news this morning, but some fun stuff as well. A little later in the show, I'm going to talk with a Greek stand-up comic.
Yes, I can't wait to hear that, Jeff. And also, we're going to hear about a big week in Washington, not just at the Supreme Court, but also in Congress, where there are a couple of big deadlines looming at the end of this week. All of that and more is coming up next on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
We will have to keep waiting a bit for the Supreme Court decision on health care reform. But to tide us over, we do have news this morning on the Supreme Court's decision on Arizona's controversial immigration law. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer is staking out the Supreme Court for us, and she's with me now. Good morning, Nancy.
Hey.
So first of all, what did the court let stand?
You know, the court considered four sections of the law, and it struck down three. The one that it let stand says, look, you're already in prison in Arizona. We're not going to let you go until you prove that you're not an illegal immigrant. That's the only thing, that only one of these four sections that they actually let stand.
So let's get the longer list. What falls?
Yeah, three really important sections of the law. One that said, look, if you're in Arizona, you have to carry papers with you saying that you are legal. That was struck down. Two, Arizona wanted to make it a criminal offense for you to work illegally. Under federal law, it's just a civil offense, which is not as stringent. So Arizona wanted illegal immigrants to actually be fined under criminal law. That was struck down. And number three, state police can no longer just pull people over and find out if they're legal and arrest them if they are illegal. That was struck down. So three key measures of this law, three key sections were struck down.
Now, the other case that you and I and everybody else is waiting for this week is the health reform case. And people have talked about this case and the immigration case as being sort of about federal versus state power, some parallels. Does this decision that we have today give us any insight into the health reform ruling that's right around the corner?
No. It is just almost impossible. There are no leaks from the court. It is completely leak-proof, which is pretty amazing in a town like Washington. What we do know is that Chief Justice Roberts said, we will all be back in court Thursday morning at 10 Eastern, and all remaining decisions will be announced.
All right. Well, until Thursday, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Egypt has a new president-elect. It is Mohamed Morsi, whose political party, the Muslim Brotherhood, was banned while former President Hosni Mubarak was in office. For more on what this means for Egypt and its economy, let's bring in the BBC's Shaima Khalil. She is with us now from Cairo. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, give us a sense of what we know about Mohamed Morsi.
Well, the most interesting thing about Mohamed Morsi, actually, is that he was never really considered one of the more charismatic characters, but he was very, very quietly spoken man. He was educated in the United States. He's an engineer, and he was in the high rankings of the Muslim Brotherhood. He was in the advisory bureau, and then he became the head of their political wing. Now, the big question is what that means for the rest of the Egyptians, and if they do see him as trustworthy as members of the Muslim Brotherhood do.
Has he said anything about his plans for Egypt's economy and how to bring it back after all the uncertainty of recent years?
Well, one of his big projects in his campaign was something called the Renaissance Project. And the Renaissance Project basically is bringing Egypt's economy back on its feet. He has got many advisories with a business background. The Muslim Brotherhood are known to be, you know, very savvy businessmen, but it still remains to be seen how that is going to translate in job creation, in bringing the economy back, and bringing investment back into Egypt.
And what about the military? We reported last week that they did what looked like a power grab to weaken the presidency. So is this a weaker office than it used to be?
Well, Mohamed Morsi may be the new president, but the military, the ruling military, are very much the leaders of this country as it stands, because even though he did take presidency, the military are in charge of legislation because there is no parliament. The military are in charge of the budgetary. They even chose his chief of staff. They chose his minister of defense. And they've also chosen the time in which the constitution is going to be written. And actually, this is the real fight, Jeremy. As it stands, the ruling military holds veto over every article in this constitution.
The BBC's Shaima Khalil joining us from Cairo. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Jeremy. Thanks so much for having me.
As we just heard, one of Morsi's major challenges is to remake the economy. Egypt suffers from high unemployment and income inequality, among many other maladies. Magda Kandil is executive director of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies. Ms. Kandil, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So now that you have some resolution in the presidential race, is there an immediate impact on the Egyptian economy, would you say?
We hope so. I think the first order of business is political stability, which we have been lacking for some time. We do not know yet the powers of the president and how he's going to establish the political consensus given the institutional structure that he will be dealing with.
So with the Muslim Brotherhood now in control of the presidency and presumably perhaps the parliament as well, what kind of an economic platform does that mean?
I think they are for pro-market economy. They are catering to mobilize support and funds to the small and medium enterprises. The Muslim Brotherhood is well connected at the community level, and hopefully they will uphold the orientation of Egypt to integrate even further with the international community and to mobilize more trade flows and investment flows.
Now, the next Egyptian election is going to determine the parliament that will help write a new constitution. What would you like to see in that constitution, specifically with regards to economic principles?
I'd like to see in the constitution that we are going to preserve the ideology of a free market economy, including equal opportunities for the small and medium enterprises, and enforcing the rules and regulations that would help establish a level playing field so we would not have practices that would undermine the capacity of the largest majority of the business community to take part in the growth process.
Magda Kandil with the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, now to Washington, where the big news, of course, will be the Supreme Court's decision on health care reform. But there's another big story developing in Congress. House lawmakers have until the end of the week to deal with two big economic issues. One is a two-year transportation funding bill that puts about 3 million jobs at stake. The other is how to keep student loan interest rates from doubling for millions of new borrowers. Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us, as she is every Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what's at stake in this fight economically if Congress can't reach a deal on these two things?
Well, certainly some form of the transportation bill is going to get passed. So the bulk of the funding will happen. And the student loan interest rate issue just isn't a macroeconomic issue. I mean, certainly it matters for particular borrowers, but it's not going to be a tipping point for the U.S. economy.
But here we are at another one of these points where both sides can't agree on at least a long-term version of what they want to do. Maybe they'll pass something short-term, as you say, but what kind of an image does that give us around the world to markets and investors when they see Washington as a place where things can't get done?
Well, right now, unfortunately, global investors don't have a lot of choices about where to put their money. So they are looking past the dysfunction in Washington and buying as many treasuries as they can get their hands on. So we're still looking at record low treasury yields despite the misbehavior in Washington. I think one of the bigger concerns is what this does to confidence amongst U.S. businesses and households. The fact that we can't really know what policy is going to look like in a few months, let alone a few years, it makes it very hard to make planning decisions or have any kind of visibility.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
A report today from Bankrate.com says almost half of Americans don't have enough emergency savings to last them 3 months. Here's Sally Herships.
It's not that we're bad savers. It's just that we're really good spenders. That's one reason we don't have more money stashed away in our emergency accounts.
So if you have lots of cash lying around, it's too tempting to consume it.
Xavier Gebex teaches finance at NYU. He says consumers also underestimate the likelihood of bad events, which brings up a question worthy of King Solomon. Should we save for emergencies or retirement?
The first priority should be the emergency fund.
Tom Balcom is a financial planner in Boca Raton, Florida. He says we need to have 6 to 12 months of cash on hand, just in case. But can't we always raid our retirement funds?
The good news is that you can. The bad news is you probably don't want to.
Nevin Adams is director of the American Savings Education Council. He says cashing in early could mean handing over a third of your savings in taxes and penalties. Instead, Bankrate.com says the answer is save more money for emergencies and retirement. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
From emergency funds to Ponzi schemes, there's a new settlement related to the Bernie Madoff case, but this one doesn't involve people who invested with Madoff directly. It's about a money manager named Ezra Merkin who has agreed to pay more than $400 million to his former customers who lost billions when he, apparently, invested their money with Madoff. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Merkin claimed he was an investing guru who was actively managing his clients' money. But New York's attorney general accused Merkin of simply putting $2.5 billion into Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Many investors, including charities, nonprofits, and universities, didn't know Merkin was sending their money to Madoff. Finance lawyer Bill Singer says they should have asked more questions.
The average American will spend days, if not weeks, looking into buying a used car and test driving that car, but they will, without a second thought, write out a check to somebody they know nothing about to put in an investment that they haven't confirmed, and then whine and complain and cry when they find out that they've been defrauded.
With this settlement, Merkin's customers will receive an average 40% of the money they lost. Other suits involving money lost to Madoff are pending. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So, with more Americans switching to tablet computers to watch movies or play video games, the Electric Power Research Institute wanted to know what that would mean for electricity consumption. Well, Jeff, do you have any guesses how much it costs to keep an iPad charged for an entire year?
Yeah, I don't know, a few, $5, $10 maybe?
It's actually $1.36. That's the annual cost.
Bargain. Yeah.
Which is far less than it costs to power a desktop PC. That will cost you $28 a year in electricity bills.
I had no idea my desktop was that expensive.
Yeah, it's a real guzzler.
Wow. Well, here's another iPad item for you. For the second time, reportedly, Apple Store employees have prevented an Iranian person from buying an iPad. So the latest occurrence was in the state of Georgia. An Iranian-American teenager walks into an Apple store, wants to buy an iPad. She's speaking Farsi, so they know, because there's an Iranian employee, they know that she is Iranian, and she's denied. What do you think is going on here? You got any idea?
No. What's going on?
Well, this is Apple enforcing U.S. sanctions against Iran.
Wow.
Yeah. Apparently, you know, we're not supposed to sell a whole bunch of things to Iran, right? And to be used in Iran, let's say, including apparently iPads. And so Apple Store employees have, when they know that a device is going to go back to Iran, and in this
they
case,
they have to say no.
Yeah. In this case, I guess the employee understood the conversation and knew that this iPad was going to be headed to a cousin in Iran and would not sell it to the girl. In any case, Apple told her, just go online and buy it there, and we won't ask any questions about it.
Well, makeup and the cosmetics counter may be more associated with women than men, at least traditionally, but it turns out that one of the fastest growing segments of the cosmetics market is products geared towards men. That's according to the research from Mintel, and it says sales of men's toiletries could hit $3.2 billion by 2016.
So Jeremy and I will admit to not knowing a lot personally about male cosmetics, so we're going to find out what's going on behind the boom. So we brought in Amy Ziegler. She's a global personal care analyst. I love that title, Amy, at Mintel, and she's with us for today's Midday Extra. Thanks for being here.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So what's going on? Why have the sales for men's cosmetics been growing so dramatically lately?
You know, there's a lot of different reasons, but if you think about a lot of things, societal pressures, we know men are competing for jobs in the workplace. A lot of men, particularly older men, are jumping back into the dating pool, really wanting to look their best. So this stigma of kind of having a beauty routine or caring about your appearance is definitely diminishing among men. And that's really what's driving a lot of the sales of these products, as well as from a retailer perspective. You know, we're seeing a lot of brands really kind of harness this stigma, offering in-store locations where men can shop for these types of products, whether it be online as well. To really increase the awareness of the segment is definitely kind of driving it as well.
And what are men buying exactly?
You know, it's interesting you ask. This is not typically the cosmetics you think of when you're thinking about a woman's makeup cabinet. These aren't, you know, the mascaras and the blushers and things like that. It's really more these kind of skincare type products. So they usually have a skincare base, and whether it be kind of a tinted product or a correcting product or something that has kind of an advanced anti-aging benefit, that's where we're seeing the most growth. I think the important thing to note about the men's segment is that it is a lot more subtle and it's much more low-key. Men don't really want to be bragging about using these types of products. Mm-hmm. While they're okay to be buying them and using them, it's not something they really want to advertise to the world. So much more on the down low for this type of category.
Now, I know that many years ago, maybe even 10 years ago or so, when Queer Eye for the Straight Guy was a big hit, that drove a lot of men probably into some of the stuff that they weren't thinking about before in terms of personal care. Has that trend changed in any way? Was that a big moment for this? Is that what started this? What's going on with that kind of stuff?
You know, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, because for some people that could have driven them to the segment, but for others, I think that could have driven many away. I don't think it's so much this metrosexual man anymore, but it's more that everyday man who's using the product. It's more about caring for your skin, wanting to look your best, not so much flaunting these types of products. And a lot of what's driving this is a lot of countries we see outside of the U.S., men's cosmetics and men's products are really the norm. So it's not really as much of an emerging segment. It's already fairly established. So I think it's just a lot of those trends coming over as we see these brands kind of entering the U.S. market with women's products. They're bringing their men's lines as well.
Amy Ziegler, Global Personal Care Analyst at Mintel. Thanks a lot.
Yes, thank you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
In the spirit of environmental conservation, the British government wants to put a price on nature.
That's right. So they've created a group called the Nature Capital Committee to come up with a financial value for landscapes, river purity, and wildlife. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This landscape with its babbling brook and warbling birdsong might be described as priceless, but that's not good enough for Oxford economist Dieter Helm. He wants to know exactly what it's worth.
How much will we be willing to spend to protect that asset, to forego the other things we could do on that landscape? A couple of million, 100,000, or very little?
Helm is head of the new Natural Capital Committee. He says if you really want to protect a scenic view or a species like the Natterjack toad, you can't rely on vague and emotional arguments anymore. You've got to put a value on the asset.
We have trashed an enormous amount of our natural environment, so not placing a value on these things has been highly unsuccessful.
Putting a price on nature, on its recreational value, for example, won't be easy, but Helm says it's worth a try. The developers are wary of the new approach. John Stewart speaks for the House Builders Federation.
If we are to protect the natural environment because we say that it has a certain value, that has consequences, and one of the consequences is we don't provide enough housing.
Oddly enough, some environmentalists are also nervous about the new committee. Craig Bennett is with Friends of the Earth.
A lot of people's approaches to landscape is subjective, and that makes it almost impossible to really place a value on it.
And he says once you do put a number on a natural asset, it becomes easier to focus only on the economic benefits of development.
The danger is actually if this committee is used by parts of the government that want to just find excuses for building over some of our most precious wildlife sites.
But what price the Natterjack toad or the redback shrike? Dieter Helm says we must take the environment into account. And maybe the best way to save the planet is with an accountant. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Greece's major lenders had planned a visit to the country today, but wouldn't you know it, the brand new finance minister has been fainting and he's been sick to his stomach. So one day on the job, Jeremy, and that's all it took apparently to send this particular guy's body into revolt.
It's really a weird story, isn't it?
I would be stressed out, wouldn't you?
Well, but the two of them, it's not just that guy. It's both the finance minister and the new
prime minister
right. are sick, right?
He's got some kind of eye thing, which who knows if you can if you can chalk that up to the financial crisis. But, you know, if Greece weren't so sad, it would be funny. Maybe it is. Maybe it is still funny. We're chuckling about it. Of course, we're not Greek. But this guy is. Manos Kanellos is a stand-up comic in London. He goes by Manos the Greek. And Manos, welcome to Marketplace.
Good to speak to you, Jeff.
So Greece is in the news almost every single day. How does it feel to be a Greek these days?
On the one hand, I feel sometimes embarrassed about the actions of my compatriots. On the other hand, I also do enjoy the publicity we are having. I mean, last week we were, for example, the top news on Al Jazeera.
Congratulations.
The last time that Greece was the news on Al Jazeera was in 490 BC, after the Battle of Marathon.
Better late than
I remember
never.
The headline, Greece saves Europe from the Persians. Europe will always owe a huge debt to Greece.
You're concerned about your home country, of course. Are there any solutions as you think about what's going on in Greece? Any solutions that you've come up with?
If I was in charge, I think I would open up the economy because we have still a closed economy. I would tax heavily the high-income people, the church and the ship owners. And when I say ship, I mean the boats, not the four-legged animals. I would explain that the last 30 years has not been normal life. It was a party. The Germans are not happy to pay the bill. They do not understand what a party is. So we need to work hard and pay our taxes.
Do the Germans even know how to party like the Greeks? Do they even get it?
Exactly. They can't. They can't. They don't know because, and I don't blame them. They don't have the weather for it. Why not make holidays compulsory for all Europeans? That is one solution. But I think the more realistic solution for a way out of this crisis, a good word, by the way, it's Greek.
Yes.
A good way to finish this drama, another Greek word, mm-hmm. and avoid catastrophe, another good word, is to actually put copyright on Greek words. Mm. If Mr. American, you want to call your spacecraft to the moon Apollo, a nice Greek word, please give us some money.
Manos Kanellos on stage. He goes by Manos the Greek. Great to talk with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, if you can find some humor in some dark places, we are putting a call out for your economic crisis jokes. You can go to marketplace.org, leave a comment, or tweet it with the hashtag crisis jokes, and maybe you'll hear yours on the air.
Here's one we were bouncing around the office this morning. This is credited to a commentator on CNBC. But the economy is so bad, my financial advisor recommends only two positions, cash and fetal.
You know, I remember the car guys on Car Talk. I remember them saying, they said, if I ever abided by the policy of don't put more into your car than it's worth, I would never fill it up with gas. So there you go.
They like to rip on their own cars.
Indeed. Well, the board of the University of Virginia is meeting tomorrow to consider reinstating Teresa Sullivan to the presidency. She was ousted by the board a couple weeks ago. It's caused a big firestorm there in Charlottesville, plunged the university into a public relations crisis. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story now from our education desk at WYPR in Baltimore.
Members of UVA's board thought Sullivan wasn't moving fast enough to respond to challenges facing all public universities. There was pressure on her to cut costs amid declining funding from the state, to increase online education, and to better compete for top faculty and students. Kent Shabatar is president of Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina. He says many board members come from the business world.
They're used to change at a very different pace. So I think that's what's causing some of the disconnects.
It's not a corporation where you can just institute policy and everyone falls into line.
That's Kevin Carey with the New America Foundation, a nonprofit think tank. He says UVA doesn't need to adapt as quickly as other schools. It's cushioned by a $5 billion endowment, the largest per capita of any public university, and, at least until now, a stellar reputation. Guilford's Kent Shabatar says the scandal is a teachable moment for all of higher ed. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
According to some new analysis by the Wall Street Journal, using American Bar Association data, newly minted lawyers have only about a 50% chance of being employed as lawyers 9 months out from graduation. That doesn't sound too terribly good. We wanted to ask someone about it, so we have Edward Birmingham. He is an associate dean at the Creighton University School of Law. Professor Birmingham, great to talk with you.
Good talking to you, Jeff.
We've been hearing for a number of years about lawyers, among many other professions, struggling during the recession. With job prospects getting worse, are fewer people going to law school?
Yes, the applications have been down. I think they're down around 15% this year, and that's why we cut our class in order to maintain the quality.
In the medical field, we've heard a lot in recent years about the problem that too many doctors want to be surgeons and other specialists and too few want to go into family practice. Is there any sort of parallel problem for lawyers?
Well, I think there is. And the problem, of course, is the high debt that students incur. So there's a lot of need for people in smaller towns, but it's harder and harder for the law grads to take those jobs because it's just hard to pay off the big loan payments and so on.
Sure. Are there any solutions in the offing to try and supply more of those small-town lawyers and public defenders?
Well, we were over in Des Moines last week at the Iowa State Bar Association, and folks there, the Bar Association and the deans of the law schools are getting together to come up with a plan to have externships in small towns because there are great opportunities there, but it's hard to get the students interested. So we're doing that. And at Creighton, we're tending to try to get more folks from outstate Nebraska and smaller towns in Iowa, hoping that they'll be more interested in going back to those places.
Well, Edward Birmingham, Associate Dean at the Creighton University School of Law in Omaha. Very good to talk with you. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Well, while we wait for the Supreme Court ruling on health care, Jeff, the big question in the UK's High Court is whether Subway's meatball marinara sub has to be heated up before it is eaten. That's the big question that they want to know over there. Because if it does have to be heated up, the government says it should be subject to a tax. They tax anything that has to be heated to, I think the wording is different than ambient temperature or something like that, above ambient temperature. Okay. But Subway says that with the meatball marinara, they've got to heat it up for food safety reasons.
I would say they've got to heat it up because otherwise it's disgusting. Not to eat a cold meatball sandwich. That is this a particular British thing?
Listeners, by the way, you can send all the letters, the legal complaints from Subway straight to Jeff.
Well, I don't think, is there much argument that you should not, that eating a cold meatball sub is just kind of gross?
Probably wouldn't be too tasty.
Let me just be clear. I have ordered the meatball sub. I have enjoyed it, but I have enjoyed it hot. And so I sympathize with Subway here. What are you going to do? But is this a particular British thing, Jeremy? The tax on stuff you heat up?
I guess it is. I was wondering whether this would be a situation where, if it were happening in the United States, this would be a 5-4 decision. Would they have a taste test among the justices to see what they thought, whether it needed to be heated up or not?
It would be all about Justice Kennedy.
All about Justice Kennedy.
How does he like his meatball subs?
That's right. They'd have to find out. Well, a decision, Jeff, is expected sometime after lunch, I'm imagining.
Naturally. Okay. Well, this is the Marketplace Midday Update in Los Angeles. I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. In New York, it's APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.